Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Knightsky. Today's topic, kids and pediatric care. My guest today is Dr. Dan Hagerman, who is a pediatrician in Cedarburg, Wisconsin. We're going to talk about everything from the healthy state of kids in America to why kids are picky eaters to allergies, all the way to his hygiene hypothesis. And it's just a good, true conversation on his approach and his philosophies about pediatric care. Please join me for this great conversation with Dr. Dan Hagerman. Today with me is Dr. Dan Hagerman, who is a North Shore, Milwaukee pediatrician. I first met Dan Hagerman in 2001, right before the birth of my son, Charlie. Dan is an impressive man who's very trustworthy, integral, and compassionate, standing well over 6 foot tall with giant hands that I recognized the first time he held my son in his hand upside down, and I was freaking out. But he said, remember, this is a human being. He's incredibly, incredibly elastic. Dan is a pediatrician who's well known in the region, and I'm excited to have him here on the podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Hagerman.
Thanks a lot, Ted.
So tell us where you grew up and a little bit about yourself.
Well, I moved around a bit. My dad worked for IBM, which used to be known as I've Been Moved. And so I lived in Toledo for my first 6 years. That's where I was born. And then we moved to the Detroit area. And then my dad and family moved to Waukesha in 1970 with the plan for an 18-month project. And my family is still all here in Wisconsin. So I grew up in the town of Brookfield, Waukesha. I went to Waukesha South High School.
Awesome. And I didn't know the Ohio part, because your office here is filled with Badger stuff. So
go Badgers.
You went on from high school in that area to go to UW-Madison?
I did. I went there for all of my training, for undergrad, med school, and my residency.
So take us back to high school and middle school a little bit. Any teachers in there? Anyone prompt you into medicine, science? Where did this passion come from?
You know what? I don't necessarily have a teacher from that era of my life, but I do have a teacher who was someone who really imprinted on me, who made a big influence on me from medical school. A guy named Bill Seeger. Bill is a god in pediatric nephrology, which is kidney disease, and was former chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin, and had recently retired. And Bill went to medical school with my class, and it was a really cool thing. He came to class. He was that voice of sort of, this is how the real world works in the midst of med school classes and stress and all these things. He actually came to parties. We played tennis, we played golf, and he just became a real mentor in my life. In fact, he gave our class's sort of commencement address, and he said something in that commencement address that has really stuck with me ever since. And he said that there are times in medicine where you're not really sure what to do next, where there's not clarity in the diagnostic course or the treatment course. He said, just remember this, do nothing stupid, which seems like pretty good advice, right? He said, if you're still not sure and you're puzzling, put a comma after nothing. Do nothing stupid.
So, that's pretty awesome.
It's a great thing to think. And it is something that I do think about, because in modern medicine, often there's this sense that we have to do something, that we always have to look more or treat more or give more pills or those kind of things. And so this is a good sort of something. It's always a little bit in the back of my brain.
Sounds like a great t-shirt to give out to anybody who's about to head off to school.
That's true.
In any matter.
Yeah.
Do nothing or do nothing, comma, stupid. So tell us a little bit about, like, one of my favorite things. You're the reason I have to wear these socks all the time. And now you don't even wear socks. But you've got all these little great little things about you that endear you to your patients, you know, the kids. And tell us about, like, going to college in the tuba.
Yeah.
Because that's, so, I think that's one of the Nightsky favorite stories about you.
Yeah, I was in the UW band and played the tuba and, you know, did the tuba thing around Camp Randall Stadium at the beginning of the fourth quarter every game and stuff. And it was a great experience. So I'm a lifelong Badger fan, love Badger sports, football, basketball. It's where I met my wife, Janelle. Sophomore year on homecoming day, actually, which is kind of cool. My oldest daughter and my youngest daughter, I have three daughters, went there. My youngest is a senior there. So.
Awesome. So. And what did you take in life from your experiences in music?
Well, you know, music has always been part of my life. I did piano lessons as a little kid, played various instruments. And in college, I picked up the guitar. My roommate freshman year in college played guitar, and I went, can I pick that up and learn? And so I still play guitar. I play in church band, and it's a lot of fun. It's one of the highlights of my life to make music.
So, yeah. How cool is that?
Yeah, it's fun.
So no like tuba trio at the coffee shop or something. So you were able to go both rhythm and melody there. Well done.
I have a tuba, but it comes out about once a decade.
Right, right.
It will definitely come out this year when the Badgers win the national championship.
There you go. Awesome. And the optimism there too. Well, it'll be a cool grandpa trick someday too for you with those three girls.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your entrance into pediatrics. What got you into this? So you went to undergrad at UW, and then you went to medical school at UW as well?
Well, you know, there's two reasons that I became a pediatrician. One of them was I liked the people who I worked with in pediatrics. Pediatricians tend to be nice people, you know, caring people. And then the other is really there's only one good reason to be a pediatrician, and that's that you like kids, you know. And kids actually bring me energy, make my day more fun, make my day more interesting. So, you know, that's how my days stay fun is I get to play with kids, you know. I juggle for them, or I do fun little games with them. And, you know, little kids, you just play peekaboo with them. That's all
right.
They're delighted.
Trick them into taking a shot or other pieces like that. So tell me what that's like, actually. Charlie's born June 2002. You're the third person to handle him. And, you know, 15 and a half years later, you're still talking to him about things. Same thing with our daughter, Grace. What's that like that you get to go, you know, kind of start of life to beginning of adulthood with a kid?
It's actually phenomenal. I mean, it's really and not just with the kid, with the parents, you know. I consider myself as much the doctor of the parents and the family as just the kid. It's just an amazing thing to watch kids grow up. And one of the things that makes my day really interesting is that I go from a 2-week-old to a 21-year-old to a 4-year-old to a 16-year-old, all with different problems and different issues and different ways that I need to approach that patient to get their trust and to let me examine them or help them. And also then completely different relationship in each of those situations with the parents. So, and you know, what I at the base level, I consider myself a teacher.
Right? Yeah.
I really teach parenting and teach health. It's all about good communication in the end. That's, if you want to be a good doctor, you got to be a good communicator.
Yeah. It's funny you said that about the relationships and the people in pediatrics. I was just at a conference where I was there speaking to cancer doctors about empathy.
Yeah.
Because the problem on their feedback from customers was that they seemed to completely lack empathy. Mm-hmm. Because they would come in and say, you have a 14% of this, an 8% of this. And all people wanted to hear was like, am I going to be okay? And they were very, this is the facts and these are those pieces. So that's reassuring to hear from you. Tell us about your residencies in pediatrics. You know, So you're a dad now, you weren't then. I mean, so what was that journey like? Where did you do your residencies and who are some of your mentors along the way there?
So my residency was, again, still at the University of Wisconsin and, really a fantastic pediatric training department there and got great experience in all sorts of things. Worked with some fantastic people. A guy named Greg Landry was one of my other real mentors. He was my clinic mentor. So I had a clinic sort of under him during residency. And so you develop your own panel of patients, but he's kind of still their doctor too. But that relationship was fantastic. He shared so much insight with me and showed me so many things that I've incorporated into my practice and stuff. And in fact, so many people like that. I mean, just countless people. And actually, many of the people who assist in training medical students and residents do it on a volunteer basis, right? Mm-hmm. It's not something that's necessarily paid. And it's a real pay it forward kind of thing, right? So I continue. I teach medical students. I teach residents. And I feel really strongly about that sort of give it back sort of thing, because so many people did it for me. And, you know, those just sometimes little tips and tricks and nuanced things that you learn from seeing lots of different people do this that then you incorporate into your own practice are phenomenal.
Yeah. What were some of your surprises then as a young kind of aspiring doctor when you, like you said, you're with a 4-year-old, a 21-year-old, a 16-year-old, a 3-month-old in a period of an hour? I mean, what were some of those? Because as you're speaking, it's very similar to like when I student taught. I had all these great mentors. I had all these great people in my life. I was very fortunate. A lot of people like taking you under your wing. But there were a lot of days where it was like, holy moly, I had no idea this existed. So What were some of those for you?
Parents are really willing to put their trust in you when you're even a new trainee and you're not always sure what you're doing. And it's a phenomenally powerful thing. I developed some amazing relationships with kids that I cared for in the hospital and things like that. And there's an amazing bond that occurs when you as a doctor say to some, and you don't say it necessarily, but I'm going to help your child. And there's this contract that occurs, and the phenomenal trust there that people put into that relationship is amazing. And it's way more now as I, you know, develop my own patients and work with these kids and families over the years and stuff. And, you know, it's a powerful thing to know that people really see you as this incredible trusted advisor.
Well, and again, it goes back to, you know, you're viewed as that expert. And the moment we ask you a question, when your child is sick or they have a behavior issue, you're the expert and I'm coming to you in a great time of need. Mm-hmm. So just to hear that you and many of your colleagues recognize that, I think is reassuring, because it's a very vulnerable moment when the door closes and you say, I don't know what's wrong, or I don't know what I'm doing, or what should I do?
Well, and it's a very humble moment for us too. And as a physician, because we don't have all the answers. We don't always have an easy, quick, I know exactly what this is, and this is what we're going to do. And one of the things that I think is really important is effectively communicating that and letting people know, these are the things that I know and understand. These are the things that I don't. These are the ways we're going to try to figure it out. And not be paternalistic or be, oh, don't you worry, we'll take care of things. It's all communication. It's all talk it out. It's all shared decision making.
So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here. Yeah. How has the internet impacted that ability for you to say it might be one of these three things? When somebody comes in here with, you know, WebMD saying, I think it's one of these 8 things based upon my criteria. It's like if you went to college and you read psych books, like you walked out thinking you had all these mental issues after you read chapter 2.
Right.
Same thing, I'm guessing, for you. So how has that impacted, you know, your ability to be vulnerable and say, it might be this, it might be this, opposed to you self-proclaimed internet experts?
Yeah, and to some extent that's a problem, but it's also somewhat empowering for people to have better sources, you know, to know things. Sometimes you get the people who think they all have it all figured out, and, you know, WebMD and these other things have a certain level of complexity that's not as high as the complexity of a real decision-making situation with a real patient. I always joke to people, if you go on WebMD for something with your kid, it's either going to be cancer or meningitis. Those are the only two diagnoses that anyone comes in with.
Right. But how horrible for them for waiting 3 days to get in here thinking, yeah, one of those two things is happening. That's why, I mean, I remember you telling us and other doctors as well, like, don't go on there. You create a story in your head that's making it much worse. And I shouldn't be here to provide you relief. I should be here to show you the path to wellness.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me some of the trends you've seen here grow over your career. Because this, how many years have you been practicing now?
24.
24 years. So in two plus decades, what kind of things have evolved, changed, and impacted you?
Well, there are so many, but, you know, one of the things is I think we're in an interesting time where we have a society that's way more health conscious than it ever was. Yet in so many ways, we're less healthy. You know, the obesity epidemic is huge. Childhood obesity is growing dramatically. And you know what? For the most part, what that comes down to is that we're hunter-gatherers in a time of plenty who don't have to gather or hunt. So we sit around and we gorge ourselves, and this is children and adults alike, you know. And, you know, what we need to be doing is get outside and get moving and be active and put down the bag of chips. You know?
How do you guide a parent through that conversation?
Yeah, it's nuanced, right? We, especially with the child in the room, we want to be careful not to send messages that are hurtful at all, right? And parents too, you know, we as our parents, you know, it's hard to for us to maybe hear that our kid has a problem, is overweight or whatever. So it's subtle and nuanced, but it's really about you know, healthy eating. What's healthy eating? You know, do we need, you know, processed foods and 90% of our intake to be carbs, or should we be eating stuff as it comes from the earth, you know, and eating natural foods and whole foods and things like that? So that's a big part of it. And then it's finding something that gets a kid interested in moving, you know, and it's different in every kid, whether it's going for walks or doing a sport or taking dance, or, you know, there's a million different things, and it's finding the thing that works for that kid, for that family.
And I'm going to ask you this, and this may be sensitive, but in my world, in the education, or our world, in the education world, there's a greater divide more and more between the haves and the haves not. There's greater poverty than ever before, and you can see trends in diet, health, attitude, behaviors in those differentiate. How do you approach that? I mean, because, you know, when a family's primary source of dinner is a McDonald's, a Dairy Queen, a Culver's, and not that there's anything wrong with those in general, but like daily,
right?
How do you approach that different type of nuance? Because, you know, when you have the means, when you're blessed or fortunate to have that, you can have that conversation, go home and, you know, throw the Oreos out, and now we're going to eat granola bars or whatnot. But in other cases, how do you approach that? And the reason I ask is because public schools are often given the task of fixing all of these things. So, like, you know, juvenile diabetes and obesity, those become public school issues. Like, you can't serve ketchup anymore because there's too much sugar, and you can't serve pizza sauce because there's this, and we need you to reduce that, and we need every kid to have X amount of legumes every day. And you're like, well, how is this going to help out the issue? So how do you approach that differentiation between them?
Well, a couple thoughts about it. One is, you know, I live and I work and practice in Cedarburg, which is a, you know, pretty upper middle class suburb of Milwaukee. And we don't have a lot of that poverty, although it's definitely here, you know. So, and we see it, and it's definitely a challenge because the foods that are good for us are often more expensive, right? And so that is difficult. It, you know, in most inner city areas in the United States, there's very limited access to those foods, even, you know, convenience stores are maybe the primary source of groceries, and you can't get those good healthy foods. So it's a societal problem. That's a big one. The other thing that's difficult with pediatrics is we can have all the good intentions we want to get kids eating healthy. You got to get the kid to eat the food, right?
Right.
And that's,
right.
I know, a problem at school lunches. They try to make stuff healthy and then the kids dump it. Well, that doesn't help anyone, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a real challenge. It's, you know, we've got lots of data on how to help this and, you know, in terms of how to get kids more interested in other foods. There's a very interesting book published last year by the American Academy of Pediatrics Press called the Healthy Eater Project. I'm sorry, the Picky Eater Project. And what they did is they took kids who were really picky eaters and they taught them how to cook and they gave them cooking classes. And they got them interested in cooking techniques and how to cook things that are healthy and things like that. Once a child is interested in those things and has invested time and energy into making something, then they're much more likely to eat it. So it's a strategy that I recommend for my parents a lot.
Yeah, that's a great tip.
Yeah,
here's how to pan fry salmon.
Right, exactly.
But then you're more likely to eat it.
Right, exactly.
That's fantastic. So tell me some more about what are some of the trends you've seen in health, wellness of kids as far as, you know, kind of this miracle of science where, you know, we have all of these things we didn't have when I was a kid. So you've got latex allergies, so the balloon-free schools. You have allergies, peanut-free schools, any nuts, any, you know, different celiacs, all of these different pieces where there's a perceptual explosion of it.
Yeah.
How has that impacted you, or what are the other changes you've seen in addition?
Well, let's talk about allergies a little bit because that is an important thing. And allergies have clearly been on the rise. There's no doubt about that. And it's legit. It's real. There's also, though, I think to some extent, a heightened anxiety over allergies that isn't always necessary. The situation where someone who is in the same room or next to someone eating an allergen and that something would happen to them allergic is at least incredibly rare and might even be mythology, right? So I think, you know, most of these situations where you have peanut-free rooms and peanut-free tables and peanut-free schools and things like that are completely unnecessary. I had a family years ago who I saw a kid who had hives after eating peanuts, and I told them that you know, he has a peanut allergy, and this is, you know, you avoid peanuts, and here's an EpiPen in case he gets exposed. And a couple days later, I got a notification back from his school that they were making the entire school peanut-free and that they wanted me to sign off on it. I was, what? No, I didn't say that. So we got to be smart about not overreacting to allergies. Not that we don't take them seriously, right? They can be very serious. Fortunately, we've really had a quantum shift in how we view prevention of allergies now in pediatrics. And so this is an example of something that happens occasionally in medicine. It made sense for a long time for us to believe that withholding allergens to kids till they were older would help prevent them from developing allergies. It was wrong. And we had finally good data. Someone actually did the science about 5 or 6 years ago, and there were 3 studies published that showed, lo and behold, if we expose children to allergenic foods early, we dramatically reduce their risk of allergies. So, and this is what we've been doing now and recommending for about the last 5 years. And we really expect to see a significant drop-off in the rate of food allergies because of that change.
Do you think that there's any correlation with the science and the medicine, healthier you know, developmental periods while still being carried, and those different you know, allergies and onsets of early things as a result of just better science, better health, better prenatal pieces? Because that's something, I don't know if that's an old one. You hear that once in a while, like, well, everyone's living longer and more kids are surviving when, you know.
So there is a piece to that. And, you know, if you look at adult populations, you know, it was, you know, 100 years ago, average life expectancy for a woman was 50 years, you know. And so we don't get many cancers before we're 50. And life expectancy is shorter for women then because of deaths in childbirth. And So in terms of cancers and adult medicine things, just living longer is a huge factor in that, right? For allergies, asthma, some of these other autoimmune type diseases, there's fairly strong evidence that is related to, the term is called the hygiene hypothesis. And the hygiene hypothesis states that we live in too clean a world. We're not exposed to enough germs, we're not sick enough, and we're not dirty enough, and so our immune system is idle. And so parts of our immune system that otherwise would be fighting off parasites, for example, which 100% of humans had parasites up to 80 years ago, for you know. And so that part of our immune system is not doing anything now. And that's the part of the immune system that's involved in allergies and asthma and eczema and some of these autoimmune disorders. And so it gets sort of out of control.
So playing the dirt's a good thing.
It is. It is. Absolutely. Well, I tell you, you know, you're probably the same way, but when I was a kid, I was 5 years old living in Toledo, in the summer, we left the house at probably 8:30 or 9 in the morning. We came back for lunch, and we left the house again, and we came back for dinner. And we were playing all day, and we were playing in the dirt, and we were doing dumb stuff that we learned from, and, you know, kids don't get to make mistakes. Kids don't get to learn things on their own anymore. That's a huge factor in parenting.
There's a really neat thing called generational range of play. And basically our parents' generation, you know, just kind of the baby boomers post-World War II, early World War II, their range of play was 5 miles. Depression area range of play was 10 miles. 10 miles from your house, 5 miles from your house.
Yeah.
Latchkey kids like me, you know, born in 70, 71, range of play 2 miles. Today, a quarter mile.
Yeah.
And it goes with risk and learning to collaborate with other kids and self-play. And there's some really neat research out there about how today's kids have everything planned for them.
Right.
And there's always an adult to intervene when there's conflict, where when you had a 10-mile range and you left your house with a fishing pole and overalls and a bucket and a ham sandwich wrapped in newspaper, if you had conflict, you had to deal with it.
Yeah.
So there's just some different nuances there. So that's another – that's a really good point as well.
Well, that's, I think, a huge trend in parenting is that we don't allow our kids to make mistakes. We don't allow our kids to take risks. And don't get me wrong, in a lot of ways that's great, mm-hmm. right? Seatbelts, bike helmets, those sorts of things are real, concrete, really save lives. Being afraid of that your child's going to be abducted, being afraid of some terrorist attack or something. These aren't things that are helpful to be afraid of
right.
in a significant way. And those things now have made parents just pull their kids in and their range of play, as you right. put it, is too tight. And we don't let kids, that happens in so many ways. Now, what happens when a kid gets in trouble in school now? The parents say that the school's the problem. They come and defend their kids. Versus when we were kids, we would have said, if that's what the school says, that's how it is.
Yeah.
And now, I'm sure there were times where that wasn't good. But for the most part, we intervene in our kids' lives, and we so desperately want them to succeed, we don't give them any opportunities to fail. And we learn from our failures. You know, these are natural consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Natural consequences are the way human beings learn the most.
So, okay, so let's talk about that for a second. So, the last arise in your career that I want to ask you about is autism, ADD, ADHD, this push for parents to diagnose what's wrong with their kid or what's right with their kid.
Yeah.
Like there's... I find this trend where everybody wants to, you know, my kid's gifted and talented. Oh, he does that because he's got ADD. This happens, that happens. I always say that over the course of my 20-plus year career in education, there's not too many kids who are much different than when I started or when I was a kid. It's just different environmental factors and technologies.
Yeah.
So where do you see with, specifically, let's start with autism.
Yeah. So, I first heard of autism in my freshman or first year med school psychiatry class or psychology class. And it was something I'd never heard of. And I would say that almost no Americans had ever heard of autism. This would have been in 1985. And because autism was a very specific disorder, it was children who were completely non-communicative, completely isolated. One of the diagnostic features of autism was that if you put your finger on the head of a child with autism, they would spin. And so it was this very, very, very specific diagnosis that was very severe. And we can chart very clearly the rise in autism with the advent of what's called DSM-1, DSM-2, DSM-3, and DSM-4 now. DSM stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And these are created by panels of experts who come up with what are the diagnostic criteria for all sorts of disorders that don't have a specific test or physical exam finding or thing to diagnose them. So you can look at a graph of the rate of autism, and it absolutely follows when DSM-1 came along and expanded the diagnosis of autism, when DSM-2, DSM-3, DSM-4 came along and expanded the diagnosis into this much broader umbrella of much less severe things. When one of the things I remember when I was in grade school, there was a wing of my grade school, which now we'd call special ed, but then it was called the section for the retarded kids. And so I know that's a taboo word now, but what's happened is that we've had largely diagnostic replacement. And so children who 30, 40, 50 years ago would have had a diagnosis of mental retardation. And I understand it's pejorative and it's got negative connotations and I'm not defending it, but those children now are mostly called autistic spectrum disorder. And so it's really a diagnostic substitution case mostly. Might there be something else that's caused some rise in autism? Yeah, there probably is something else. We don't know exactly what it is. We know that it's not vaccines, right? The people talk about the autism epidemic, and it's mostly this diagnostics substitution concept.
And I think what's really neat, one of the things for what you just said too, because I think anyone 40 plus years old can remember the wing or the basement of their school,
yeah,
is that today in 2017, those students enjoy equal rights, sit right next to everybody else, are accepted. Other kids change their behaviors to learn to work with the true societal pieces. And it's no longer necessarily a curse, but more of a gift for them and other people as well as they go through that. But I just, like I said, in my career, there's more and more kids. And that, how you just explained that, makes a lot of sense, because I think a lot of people in education, a lot of parents think there's something in the water or aluminum in the deodorant or, vaccine, whatever the myths are out there.
Sure.
But they go that way. What about the behavioral stuff, the ADD, ADHD pieces?
Yeah, so, ADHD has clearly increased in prevalence over time, too. It's probably largely because people are more aware of it. Whether it's actually changed in incidence, I can't tell you. It's certainly diagnosed more. And ADHD is certainly both over and underdiagnosed, right? So in some areas, desire for our kids to do so well in school and putting so much pressure on them that if someone gets a B, then there's got to be something wrong and now they need medication for that, right? On the other end of that spectrum, though, and the part that bothers me as much is people who are overly afraid of the medications that we use for ADHD and therefore don't get their kids the help that they really need. Because when we do this right, these medicines really, really help kids, right? When we do it wrong, we over-medicate, mm-hmm. So there's a real increase, but there's also societal demands on kids that if, when they're in third grade, if they're not the top of their class, that they won't be able to go to Harvard now.
And like you and I talked about before, sometimes those recommendations come from the school. Like, hey, you might want to go get your kid checked. And how have you – so you started with a great piece of, as a pediatrician, you're doing just as much teaching as you are diagnosing. How do you help a parent who comes in, with that story in their head that, I think my son's just got a hyperactivity disorder or, can't sit still, can't focus, can't concentrate. What are your first steps and interventions that you walk through with the parents?
Well, the first step would be try to make a appropriate diagnosis. And is this something that's a real problem or is it not? And unfortunately, there's no bright lines that separate those things. But we talk in detail with the family. We get input from teachers and other people involved in kids' lives. We apply sort of criteria, again, like from the DSM-IV again, to try to get to a point whether we think this is a significant problem or not. And one of the major features of making that diagnosis is to ascertain how much it's the problem is affecting a kid. How bad are they doing? How significantly does it impact their ability to function in the classroom or to do their homework or to be organized or to get along with other kids or whatever? So we start there and we try to come to some sense of clarity between me and the parents and the kid, depending on how old they are, on whether we can make that diagnosis confidently or not. If we can't, but we feel like we need to go further, then there's further testing that can be done. But there is no test. There's not one thing. There's not a bright line that distinguishes who does and who doesn't have those problems. There's actually growing data in a fairly recent study within the last 6 months, a meta-analysis that really looked at a lot of smaller studies and tried to bring more clarity to the issue, and that cognitive behavioral therapy really plays a very significant role in the treatment of ADHD, particularly in younger kids, and that you take a young child with ADHD and get them the right therapy and they can really learn how to self-modulate their behavior. They can learn how to have techniques to help themselves to focus better, things like that. It doesn't completely replace the medication, but it's in some kids it does, and it's certainly a significant, at least an adjunct.
Yeah. Some. My grandma Nitzke used to say, because my brothers and I were all jokingly told we were born with hyper hearts, and she would say, with little boys like this, here's what you do, and she'd open up the door.
Yeah.
And get out of here. That's and you'd go run around like maniacs. You'd come back and you could self-regulate and different mm-hmm. pieces like that. And so that's, you know, that's a couple more questions here. But one of the pieces is with those young parents and new to parenting, everybody wants to know what normal is. Right? So is this normal? Is that normal? Like, all right. So Dr. Dan, is there a normal?
Well, you know, that's a great question because that's really what I do all day. Right. When it comes to like, development, you know, you take your 15-month-old, how many words should they be saying? And what, you know, it's a scary thing for parents and oh my gosh, is there something wrong with my child? And there's this tremendous bell-shaped curve for everything, right? And so we all know that babies are supposed to walk and talk in a year, right? Everyone knows that. No, that's not true. Half of them have, because that's when it's average. At the point where something's average, half of the kids haven't done that, right? So by definition. And so we do get caught up in that a lot. And there is a really broad spectrum of what's normal. Yeah.
Well, and I think what's so powerful, again, about your position is the ability to just calm a parent and say, this is okay. Because just like in education, just because they're in ninth grade doesn't necessarily mean that everyone in ninth grade is going to operate at this level. Not all kids are going to read at the same time. Not all kids are going to be, it's not going to click for math at the same time. But unfortunately, we live in the standardized Western society where, you know, if you're not here by this point, you know, there's something wrong with you. And, you know, like we've talked about, I think that's something you have to work with parents on a pretty frequent basis of there's nothing wrong with your child.
Yeah. That's the hardest diagnosis actually, right? And it's the hardest diagnosis for people to accept. And as much as we hate for there to be something wrong with our child, once we've sort of decided that we think there is something wrong, it's hard to be convinced sometimes that there isn't.
Right.
And it comes back a little bit to Dr. Seeger's thing with, you know, do nothing, comma, stupid. And often, one of the great things in pediatrics, well, often with time, things work themselves out. You know, and so we pediatricians tend to be much less aggressive about diagnostic testing and about throwing medicines at problems and things like that, because things kind of work themselves out over time very commonly. And with that said, one of the most challenging things as a pediatrician is when is it not normal? And sometimes the nuance is very, very small, that, you know, the difference between normal and something really wrong. And it's often things that aren't exactly obvious to other people. You know, when you think about, say, a baby who's sick, how do you tell the difference between a kid who has a virus and the kid who does have meningitis or something like that? And it can be very subtle. And that's where we really earn our money, is in that edge where, when are you supposed to be worried? When do you set off bells and whistles?
Yeah, probability elimination.
Yeah.
So two more questions.
Yeah.
Drugs. What have you seen? You know, so you hear the president says the other day there's an opiate epidemic, and we see that all over the place. What do you see with young men and women in their access? And the reason I ask is because, you know, we were talking before about the limited range of play, but now with technology, the range of risk is immensely greater and quicker.
Yeah.
You know, for you and I back in the 80s, to score a six-pack of beer, you needed a plan, a buddy, a drop zone, some money, if any of us ever had done that, which we haven't. However, today it's like click, 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 risk achieved. So what are you seeing with drugs
and things? The other thing that happens, you know, the range of play, you know, when that changes, when you get the car keys.
Correct.
Right. Now the range of play is huge. And we, you know, parents who have sheltered and coddled and protected their kids forever, now all of a sudden they're free to drive wherever. And so I think more of a quantum shift that occurs now because of that concept. Once the kids get their driver's license, now there's all these new experiences that they can expose themselves to and stuff. I've had kids in my practice die of heroin overdose, you know, I've had families, expend their life savings and double mortgage their house to try to get their kids, clean and fail, you know, so that the opiates are really the scary thing, you know. Alcohol is scary, right? Marijuana is scary in its own way. But the opiates are so crazy addicting, and literally people can have one dose and be addicted, you know? So,
or die.
Right. The fentanyl, these super potent, no one knows how to handle those, you know? And it's even in cozy little Cedarburg, it's a problem, you know? And I don't know what the solutions are. It's a very difficult problem.
I have a colleague who always says the teenage years happen for a reason, and that's so it's easier to say goodbye.
Yeah. Well, the other thing about this that I think is fascinating is our modern concept of adolescence didn't exist. This is a completely new concept of the last, say, 130 years. Because the age at which you became physically mature, sexually mature, was later, years ago. It was the same age at which you were expected to be an adult. And you got married and had children, and you got a job, and you supported your family. Now, with the sort of delay of adulthood in terms of responsibility and getting a job and supporting oneself or a family, has delayed till early to mid-20s, right? Yet puberty occurs earlier, so there's this era in our life that's a completely modern construct that we still don't know what to do with, right? And we're all still learning about it.
Well, and again, I'm sure every day in your practice you are dealing with a parent of a teenager who's trying to, you know, I don't have control, they're not respectful, they're not doing what I want.
Oh, yeah.
Well, in the home, we're all wired to fight that and create our own space.
Yeah, right.
So lastly, where do you see, because this is something I'm intimately involved in on a state level, is healthcare. Where do you see this going? When you looked, you know, we talked about, you know, Cedarburg, it doesn't matter where you are, there's a growing level of poverty, there's less access. you have the greatest level of knowledge, data, science, medicine, pharmacy that you've ever had in your career. And it feels like, to me, there are less people who have access to that as we move forward. And what are your thoughts and where do you see all of this heading?
Sure. Well, again, we've got this tremendous healthcare system in America that is able to treat disease so, you know, well, yet we're not very good at promoting health. And unfortunately have, on a worldwide level, poor health outcomes. And those things are largely related to the inequity of distribution of healthcare. And I personally believe that healthcare is the most important right that a human being could have. I think it's stated in the Declaration of Independence, the life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. What's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? That's health, right? And if someone, due to no cause of their own, has a health problem, and now they can't pursue life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness like someone else, that should be an incredible societal problem, right? And yet we've got politicians trying to limit healthcare more. And I just can't see how that is even fathomable to people. We're the only country in the world where people die because they can't pay for their health care. The only developed country. Let me qualify that. And so until we seriously take health care as a right, the inequality is going to continue. And our health is going to continue to be poor. You know, the haves will get healthier and richer, and the have-nots will get poorer and less healthy.
What else did you want to share with us?
Well, that's a big question.
Yeah, well, I mean, we touched on so many topics, and, you know, this is like healthcare access. You know, you're a passionate guy, and there's – I mean, you're also a very funny guy. We really didn't goof around much at all.
No,
but
we should.
Yeah, we should have. Well, then let's end with that. Like, what's one of your funniest memories here of being a pediatrician?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. You know, this is – I wish every day practically I would write stuff down, you know, because there's so many funny things that occur. There's one that I always remember. This is years ago, but I had a kid who had recently turned two. And so she answered any question, anything that sounded like a question with two. Like, how old are you? She'd say two. Are you a big girl? She'd say two. So I said, let's go have fun. So I took the kid and the parents, and we went out in our nurse's station. There were a few people hanging around. I said to her, what's 1 + 1? And she said two. I said, what's the cube root of 8? She said two. And we went on with this, and of course it became evident pretty quickly.
But it's a great shtick.
It is. It was one of those moments in time where you got to play this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today. And I just want to end it with a note of gratitude to you and your colleagues and doctors and pediatricians everywhere. Because as a parent and as an educator, you had pointed it out early. You know, it's very humbling that you are in a position where everyone in a time of need and vulnerability come to you and ask you a question, and we trust and rely on you. And many of the podcasts are about mindset and being in a positive mindset or optimistic mindset. And I'll tell you, as we head out here, how you shaped me when my daughter was maybe 3-4 hours old. Gracie had her ear was like pinched down a little bit in development. And I was upset, like, what the heck? Why? You know, what can we do about this? And you put your hand on my shoulder as you're holding Grace with your other hand out in front of me. And you said, billions of miracles occur in 9 months to make this happen. This is not a big deal, Ted.
Yeah.
And it just immediately brought me back to, I'm blessed.
Yeah.
So thank you for doing that for me and for everybody else. And thank you for joining me on the Smart Thinking Podcast.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
That's it. That's the Smart Thinking Podcast. Thank you for joining me for this great conversation with Dr. Dan Hagerman, and please look forward to additional conversations where Dan and I will be getting together and discussing topics more specific like trauma-informed care, kids and alcohol, pressure, as well as any other pediatric
trends that are occurring. Please feel free to share this podcast and other podcasts on your social media platform. And please remember to like us on Facebook at the Smart Thinking Facebook page or the CISA 6 Facebook page. I really appreciate you joining us. I look forward to future conversations with Dr. Dan. He's going to become like, I guess, my Dr. Phil. And we'll be having great conversations to help you, help others, and get better at supporting kids and their future. Everyone is waiting on there's a song horizon, just you wait and see. Won't you take my hand and shake the world with me? There's a song horizon, just you wait and see. Won't you take my hand and shake